We hear from psychologists and other researchers that empathy is part of being human. The ability to sense what other people feel sure helps us figure out things between each other. The dark side of humanity is often chalked up to a lack of empathy. But could you define it? Many people try, and others try to teach it. These and many other people are featured in a new book called I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. It is the work of Chris Beam, who's an assistant professor of English at William Paterson University in northern New Jersey. She has written several previous books, including works on foster care and on transgender teenagers. Chris, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
It sounds like this empathy project was, in fact, born out of the foster care book.
Yeah, it was in a way. You know, I was I spent a lot of time in public schools, and I was noticing that the curriculum started featuring empathy as an actual lesson plan in many schools, and I started looking at it nationally, and it's now being increasingly taught. And I wanted to question that, and I noticed that it was being taught in everywhere from elementary and high school levels to up and through college and business school particularly. And I sort of wondered about that. I wondered why it was being taught as a rather than modeled, and whether it could be sort of numeratized and graded, and whether that was the right sort of plan and model.
Is that actually what's being done? I mean, they're actually grading on
yep.
empathy?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
So and so this you make the comparison yourself in the book about the efforts at self-esteem 30, 35 years ago. I mean, so I can imagine this produces eye rolls in some people that were
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, those of us that have been through that are like, oh, here we go again with another sort of attempt at sort of reducing teen pregnancy. And are we trying to, you know, sort of refute the social ills with another sort of social programming mode? And I think that this might be another one of those.
You say also that empathy has been weaponized by the 2016 election. How and by whom?
Well, I think that we saw a lot of people saying, you know, I won't feel empathy for the other side if they're not going to feel empathy for us. There was a lot of, you know, empathy was really a big term, I think, throughout the 90s because of mirror neurons. A lot of people were talking about empathy. And then because it was sort of in the social zeitgeist, people were saying, I'm not going to feel empathy for this other side. You know, they're not feeling empathy for me, so I'm not going to feel empathy for them, which was, I thought, was a really interesting social sort of turn that we made, to not feel empathy, to choose not to feel empathy as though that were a choice to make.
But it's interesting because it makes me think that when you talk about it being in the zeitgeist, it's sort of there in our common knowledge that in the 2016 election, we were throwing anything that could stick against each other, and
yeah.
Empathy just happened to be out there.
Yeah, exactly. It was a very interesting time, and it felt like, you know, the quote-unquote other side was being very cruel, so I'm going to be cruel back by being unempathic. And I'm not sure it got us very far.
No, indeed. But there are other terms, and I'm just kind of working through the introduction of the book here now, about the idea of corporate empathy.
Yeah, corporate empathy is really interesting. There's a lot of terms like empathic branding and empathic marketing. What they mean is, when corporations, when they know our likes and dislikes and can target products to us individually, they call this empathy. So companies are no longer, you know, this is well known to many, they're no longer sort of using the mass commercial to reach us. They're trying to reach us individually online, and they call this empathy. And I argue that this isn't just sort of a bastardization of a term. I think it's a way in our online experience that we begin to feel sort of empathized with. It's a way that empathy has shifted to sort of mean something else. So these corporations, in a way, have also been driving empathy to be taught in the schools, where, you know, schools have been teaching empathy, like I mentioned earlier, as part of their curriculum.
But corporations favor that, you say, and support it?
Yeah, because they're saying that young people need to be empathic as part of their skill set when they're entering the workforce. So they're really pushing for this, which makes me question what kind of empathy we're talking about. It may not be the sort of generic pre-theory kind of empathy that you and I might think, oh, well, empathy is a good thing, so we should teach it in the schools. If it's being driven by a sort of corporate mindset, we want to question it a little bit more.
Oh, in the sense that empathy is a technique or a tool in the toolbox, and instead of coming from an algorithm, it's coming from a real person trying to figure out what your needs are. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, in fairness, is this something that salesmen have always used? Salesmen and women, I should broaden that out and make it less gender specific. But I mean, if somebody's trying to sell you a car, it's like, you know, oh, I can see you really like those seats. You know, they're trying to show something like empathy or kinship or of some kind.
Yeah, that's true. I think that you're right. I think that there always has been that, but I think that it's a much deeper kind of work that's being done now, because now they can take all of our, they can track wherever we are online and sell every single move to these giant corporations like Axiom and others that amortize all of our moves and all of our data and sort of turn us into little bits of sort of corporate, you know, information that they can then sell to one another. So we may think, for example, on Facebook that we are the consumers, but in fact we're the product.
Right, because we're being sold to advertisers. Given all this, though, I mean, from the range of, you know, teaching kids in school to feel empathy for their classmates to the idea of empathy being used by corporations to sell us things, I mean, is the concept of empathy itself kind of coming unglued?
That's what I was questioning in this book. I really wanted to see, was it coming unglued? And the answer, I think, is no. I think there's actually empathy being practiced in some really interesting and unusual ways. And that's where I got hopeful. I came at it skeptically, like, uh-oh, what's happening to empathy? And then my answer was, actually, we're doing some really interesting things.
All right, we'll explore the research and much more when we come back and talk more with Chris Beam. Her book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange, talk more with Chris. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Chris Beam, longtime journalist, assistant professor of English at William Paterson University in northern New Jersey, living in New York City, and thinking about empathy and how we view empathy, how we find empathy. Is there a place in the brain for it? Are there parts that block it? Can we be fully human without empathy? All these things and more, including how empathy is used by marketers to try to win your love and your purchases. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about Chris's book, I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Phone number is 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So three major parts to the book: one, understanding; two, justice; three, forgiveness. I do like the technique, Chris, of starting in a server farm handling our information by the empathic computing industry, and then switching to a prettier story, Giacomo Rizzolatti working with monkeys. What has he been doing over the years?
You know, Rizzolatti discovered mirror neurons and macaques. And this, you know, what was interesting about the mirror neurons is not necessarily what they did, but the spillage, what they tended to represent. The idea is that these neurons fire when a monkey witnesses another doing something, say reaching for an apple rather than just reaching for the apple himself. These were action neurons. Usually we thought that these action neurons fired only when somebody does something, and what we saw was that they fired when they witnessed somebody doing something, and they were dubbed empathy neurons because finally we thought we had a way to explain empathy neurologically. We imagine the action that we're doing inside our brain. We know this because the action neurons are firing even when no actions are being performed. But then after this, there was a lot of controversy around the mirror neurons. One, we haven't seen them in humans, not in the exact same way that we've seen them in monkeys. And two, we can't say for sure we know what these neurons are doing. We can't say that they're performing some sort of empathic action. All we know is that they're firing. So there's been a lot of kickback. But the kickback hasn't been reported in the same way that the sort of empathy component of them has been. Suddenly people said, hey, we've got an explanation for empathy. Empathy exists. And it launched all this research into an interest in all things empathy. Suddenly, social scientists, psychologists, reporters, everyone was talking about empathy. And it sort of launched this big surge. And what I found in my research that was interesting was that we have these sort of surges every 100 years or so, and we're just in the middle of a big surge 100 years ago, there was a big surge of it when the word empathy was invented. It's only 100 years old. And then 100 years before that, there was another surge. And then in between, we get these periods of real sort of social interest in the individual, where we talk about the sort of like Rousseau's savage man, and later in another swing, Nietzsche's superhuman man, you know. So we've got these sort of interstices where we talk about individualism, and then we swing back toward something like empathy. And right now, we just happen to be in an empathy moment.
So it is. It really did open the floodgates. Rizzolatti's work did do that. Yeah.
Yes.
There's a difference, though. I mean, we're talking about one macaque would see the other one doing something and sort of feel the physicality of it. That's not the same thing as empathy, is it?
Well, it's a very low-level empathy. I mean, we don't exactly know that he's feeling that. That was a projection. You know, we just know that the neurons were firing. That's all we know. And everybody projected into it that he was feeling something. But it's a very low-level kind of empathy. I mean, when we talk about developmentally what empathy is, the first level of empathy that we begin to feel when we're in our first year of life is mirroring. It's why babies yawn when other babies yawn, or why babies cry when other babies cry. It's the first kind of level that we go through. And then that you know, the next year you begin to recognize that other people have feelings, but you think that they're the same as yours. And then in the third year you begin to recognize that people have different feelings than your own. Those are higher level empathic responses. We don't know that where in the brain that happens, or whether in the brain that happens for some people and not for others. These are much higher level cognitive kind of processes that we haven't begun to unearth neurologically yet.
So we can't say for sure that here's the empathy center in the brain. That's not that simple. Okay.
Not that simple.
Chris Beam's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. And this brings us back at this point in the book to the idea of empathic computing. So are computers picking up our stuff enough to be able to sort of reflect things back to us in ways that are not just sales?
You know, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, it's interesting. We've got all these, you know, we've got places like in Japan where they're developing robots that are supposed to feel like us, you know, so that we can be with robots that relate to us like humans, so that we can feel things. People are trying with AI to create robots that reflect back in some way. I mean, that's the holy grail of computing, is something that feels back. That's what we're trying to get to, and that we haven't quite yet gotten. We can do things that move like us, we can do things that look like us, we can do things that talk like us, but the feeling component, that's where we haven't hit yet. So it's really the empathy part that's essentially most human and is essentially most absent.
I can see it's a relatively short step, though. You come in the door grouchy one night, and you know, I'm not going to use a brand name here. I'll just say smart speaker, play some P-Funk, and then, you know, three steps of software down the road, next the smart speaker says, "You sound like you've had a hard day. Would you like to hear some P-Funk?"
Exactly. I mean, that's what we really want. We do have these empathic cars now, which pick up your body signals and will adjust to your feelings, supposedly. Like if your heart rate goes up, or if you have more sweat on your hands, or if they feel your body temperature rise, they will change the color of the dashboard. They'll play different music. They'll change the temperature in the car. So they're responding to physiological changes in the body. And they're calling that empathy. Is that really empathy? Again, it's just sort of reacting and responding to minute changes. Is it really that ineffable thing of being reflected in that very human way that we want to be reflected? I think that can only be human to human.
But it still reminds me of I forget which Ray Bradbury book or story it was, where the beds are trying harder to rock us to sleep because we're not falling asleep as easily as we should.
Right, exactly. we long for that. We long to be met in some fundamental way, and we keep trying to make our machines do it. And we're getting closer and closer, but there's some essential, and I hate to be essentialist here, but there's some essential thing that is empathy that's very hard to get to.
Truly. So let's move from machines back to people then, and tell us about Ashoka's empathy initiative.
Oh, that's interesting. Ashoka is a nonprofit organization that is trying to create empathy worldwide and build empathy for school children worldwide. And you know, it's a kind of messianic mission, which I found really interesting that that they would want that, given that they I think worldwide people have plenty of empathy and probably have their own. So I think it's I question it. They're very skill based. From my perspective, it's very much about building skills, the skill of empathy. And there's a real split in social emotional learning circles, which is the way that we teach empathy. One is a skill based, and one is a moral based.
Mm-hmm.
And Ashoka is really trying to build the skill of empathy. And when I talked with the director of the empathy initiative, she said, you know, companies are really clamoring for this skill and for people to be sort of global. This is an organization for social entrepreneurs. So for kids to grow up and be part of the global marketplace, they need this skill of empathy. So they're trying to teach it worldwide.
Which is really interesting, because I've heard this too from people who know something of the job market and economists and things like that, who talk about it's best to know some soft skills, things machines can't do. And, of course,
right.
Delivering empathy to people is one of those soft skills.
Right, right. And I just, I wonder about it. I still question it as a skill. I find that troubling. I find it like it's acquisitional. I'm getting away from Ashoka here because I don't want to place aspersions on any one place.
Sure.
But I think that the idea of a moral or a value as a skill gets us into real trouble, because then we're not operating from a real doing something for the good of doing it. We're doing it because it gets us something. And that's troubling.
Chris Beam is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist and a professor of English at William Paterson University in northern New Jersey. She's written a book called I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. And we're learning about how empathy is being analyzed and probed in laboratories and taught in schools and being used by companies that want to sell us stuff. Mike in Medford has a couple of interesting questions here. He says, if you're overly sensitive in your empathy, would you be prone to mental illness such as depression? And also, would someone who is good at figuring out what other people are feeling be more proficient at manipulation?
Those are great questions. If you're more sensitive, are you more prone to depression? You know, that's a real question for a psychologist. I don't know that I have the expertise to answer that. I think that that's a psychological question, but my sense is yes. I think that the more we feel, the more we hurt. I think that there have been people that make that claim for sure, that the more that we empathize with others, the more we can suffer. And the converse is his other question, which is the more that you also feel, the more you can manipulate. Is that true? Is that what he was saying?
Yeah, that was the essence of it. Yes.
Well, that's interesting because with empathy, people think that without empathy you can be a monster, but that's not exactly true. You can be empathic and the Nazis were incredibly empathic. You know what I mean? They knew how to do incredible damage. So yes, you can be terrifically manipulative when you're empathic, because you know what the other one, what's going to do, what's going to hurt. So yeah, absolutely.
Which brings us to the point in the book where you point out self-focused and other-focused views of empathy. The terms are clear. Can you give some examples?
Yeah, you know, I think that there are, when we think about stepping into another person's shoes, which is the sort of generic way that we think about it, one of the imaginative leaps that we make is we have to sort of imagine, you know, how would it feel for me to experience what you're experiencing, and how would this feel for you to experience what you're experiencing? And those are two slightly different modes for me to experience what you're experiencing and for you to experience what you're experiencing. And there are troubles with both of those stances, because with the first one, I'm not really imagining you, and with the second one, I'm sort of projecting or colonizing you, swallowing up your agency. They're both tricky. So they're hard positions to do. You know, you want to imagine what the other person is going through, and you also want to allow them their own experience. So it's very difficult. As far as examples, you know, there's a person named Nell Noddings who says that the whole notion of projecting yourself into another person's experience is a particularly Western masculine notion of empathy. She just defines empathy as receptivity and says that one way to do it is to just receive what the other person says without projecting into imagining their experience at all. So there are many, many definitions and many ways to think about empathy.
So let's bring us back then, because as we talk about definitions, it reminds me to ask again about the creation of the word. You mentioned it's only existed for about 100 years.
Yeah, it comes from the German Einfühlung, which I'm probably mangling. I don't speak German, but it's Einfühlung.
One of our producers does. He'll make sure he corrects it later today.
It's got some umlauts in there. And it means feeling into, and it's originally an aesthetic term, an artistic aesthetic term, and it was developed as a way to feel your way into art. So the concept was, when we experience art, we don't think about it or intellectualize it. We feel it. So if we're looking at something like a Doric column, say, you feel it in your body. You feel a kind of internal straightening, and that's how we experience art. And then a lot of people sort of latched onto that term and said, hey, there's a feeling into or an empathy that we experience in other realms too. And Freud even used it and said, hey, there's an Einfühlung or a feeling into when we do psychotherapy. And so that's where empathy, the term, came from. But 100 years prior, people were using the word sympathy, and it didn't have the same sort of pitiful connotations that it does now. People were using it like the way that we use empathy. So
it's almost the difference of a preposition, I feel with you, as opposed to I feel for you.
Yes, exactly. That's a great way to put it. Hmm. Exactly.
So bring us back to the brain, Chris. We talked about the fact that we can't say home of empathy in the brain, you know, in the cortex or the amygdala, whatever. But are there structures that block empathy?
You know, it's interesting. I talked to a person named Kent Keel who studies psychopaths, and he's done brain scans of criminal psychopaths. And there's a significant chunk of neural real estate that's atrophied in the paralimbic system. In criminal psychopaths, and we don't know if this is causal or not, or if it's experiential.
In other words, if it was there already and caused the things, or if it came there
from
disuse.
What they did. Yeah. Yes, exactly. But it could be that is an area that is atrophied because of a lack of empathy, that's part of it in the paralimbic system. We're starting to see maybe some area that looks like this might be in the paralimbic system. This might be an area of empathy. It's interesting too, because we don't label kids as sociopaths or psychopaths for very obvious and good reasons. We call kids having callous and unemotional traits, but he's also scanned kids in juvenile detention centers with these callous and unemotional traits, and he found similar brain atrophy, suggesting that this may be inborn. And he says that we need to think of it as a disability, you know, and treat it as such instead of being quite so scared of it. And there's a person in Australia named Mark Dadds who's doing some really interesting work around teaching young kids with these traits to make eye contact. And because there's a theory that kids who don't make eye contact don't get the sort of positive feedback loop from their caregivers. So the parents aren't giving the kind of positive love and rewards, or the kids act worse and the parents respond worse and so forth. And the idea is that if you can train them to make eye contact and reward them for that, maybe the empathy, that can kickstart a kind of empathy. So maybe it can be learned even in areas where the brain has shown this kind of atrophy.
There's some really fascinating stuff in here. We did have Abigail Marsh on last year talking about some of the same things in her book, The Fear Factor. We'll get into that a little further when we get on the other side of a break. We're talking to Chris Beam about her book, I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Got one phone call waiting. We are welcoming others as well. Your thoughts on empathy and its uses or perhaps misuses in society. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Chris Bream and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our subject matter today is empathy. And if you're just joining us, please don't roll your eyes just yet, because we're acknowledging that people do roll their eyes when we talk about empathy in society today. Chris Beam had looked at a number of places around the world where people are studying empathy or trying to teach it in schools or trying to use it for a marketing device. She's written a book called I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Chris is an assistant professor of English at William Patterson University in Northern New Jersey and the author of a couple of books. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So before we move completely away from the idea of people without empathy, and first of all, is it a really tight connection? No empathy equals psychopathy? Is it that simple?
There are other traits that go into psychopathy besides that. There's something called the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, and there are other traits that are in there, but being lack of empathy is a big one.
Mm-hmm. All right. So but there was something that I know that I've heard in previous discussions that particularly the children who are not feeling much empathy, there's something they're just not getting. It's one emotion in particular they don't detect, apparently.
Yeah. They don't, and they don't feel fear in the same way.
And they don't see it in other people either?
Yeah, they don't see other people's fear.
Well, which would kind of be an indication, stop hitting me, that sort of thing, you know, that
right.
Level of empathy. Wow.
Right, exactly.
That's pretty amazing stuff.
Exactly.
Let us take a call here. We have Four Arrows in Talent, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chris Beam.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm enjoying your program. I've got two brief out-of-the-box questions that will probably contribute to the potential for eye-rolling. For most of human history, the phenomenon we call empathy included other than human connections. So I'm wondering if your guest has anything to say about empathy with nature, something certainly we need in these days, and you know, with animals, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second question is, Rupert Sheldrake and other researchers have made connections between telepathy and empathy, but trying to get research published on telepathy in credible journals is almost possible. I'm wondering if she has ever done any thinking about why that dividing line between the neuropsychology of telepathy and empathy.
Thanks for the questions. Good to hear from you, Four Arrows.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting, the question about empathy and nature. I don't think it's eye-rolling at all. I think that there's somebody named Laurie Gruning who writes about something called entwined empathy, and she writes a lot about animal behavior and animal treatment, ethical animal treatment, and entwined empathy is it's about seeing animals as part of our global society. And making decisions based on recognizing that we're all entwined. And I think that there's something definitely to be said for recognizing that we are part of an ecosystem and making empathic, understandable choices around that. So I think that's a very logical question. As far as telepathy, you know, I don't know anything about telepathy. I wish I did. Do you know anything about telepathy?
No, and I think I see his point there, that it's one of those things that when you start getting into parapsychology, you start getting into realms where you can't get published in professional journals and all that sort
right.
of thing.
Right. I don't know anything about telepathy at all.
Hmm. Well, that question will have to sit there for a while. I did want to come back to one thing that didn't get asked before when we were talking about teaching empathy in schools and even grading on use of it and stuff like that. Because one of the schools you visit in the book is in a very, very poor part of Washington, D.C. And I just wonder how empathy fits in with the challenges of daily life in such a tough neighborhood.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I was following an organization called Roots of Empathy, and they're based in Canada, and they're very, very popular in Canada, and they're just starting to make inroads in the U.S., and they are pretty international. They've got branches in Ireland and in Australia and in lots of areas of Western Europe, and they're just starting here. And what the program is they bring a baby into an elementary school classroom every 2 weeks for 9 months. So it's a pretty long-term program. And the baby and the parent, one baby that's consistent for the year, comes in, and the children watch this baby grow. And they...
And a real baby. We're not talking like a mechanical baby with
a
pregnancy.
No, this is not a computerized baby. This is a real baby. And the children form connections with this baby, and they learn about, what the baby might be feeling. They imagine why the baby's crying. They watch the baby start to tease. They watch the baby start to form words. And then they can talk about they develop an emotional vocabulary, really, you know, so that they can talk about their own experiences as they reflect back on what the baby might be experiencing. I was in a very poor neighborhood in D.C., and it was a mom of one of the kids in the school, and she had a brand new baby, well, not that brand new, 9 months. And, the teacher that was helping to facilitate this was wary at first. He was like, you know, these kids don't need to be softer. These kids need to be harder, was his first thought. They don't need to learn how to feel their feelings. They need to learn how to toughen up for the neighborhood that they're in. And then he was really sold on the program once it actually came in, because the kids learned to talk about a lot of the things that were going on. Forget about the baby. They learned to talk about a lot of the things that they were experiencing in their homes and in their streets. And all of us need to do that. All of us need to have ways to express what we're experiencing. And the baby helped facilitate that.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing point. It's almost, it became more of a support group because people knew a bit more about each other.
Yeah. And here were all these little 9-year-old boys, you know, on the precipice of adolescence, who were suddenly able to, it was a boys' school, all these 9-year-old boys able to express with one another what they were feeling and what they were experiencing. And that doesn't mean that they're not tough enough to go out and handle their neighborhoods, but they were also able to release some of the feelings that they had about, their life.
Well, let's take a call here. We have Harry and Wairika on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking empathy with Chris Beam.
Thank you very much. My concern is what's going on in Congress right now.
No kidding.
That,
me too.
The idea that heating oil isn't necessary, meals on wheels is not necessary, food stamps should be restricted, gun rights supersede human rights. What do we do about empathy?
Putting empathy into government is what you're talking about, huh?
What do we do? Please.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting because I think, when I was writing this book, empathy was a really vibrant part of the national conversation because Obama put it front and center. He was often talking about empathy when we were electing Judge Sotomayor. Empathy was a big part of the conversation.
Right, yeah, and of course, as you point out, the world went crazy. It's like, what? Empathy in a federal
empathy
justice?
In a courtroom? Oh, my gosh. You know, it was wild at that time. And now here we have, as the caller rightly points out, we've got a government that is cutting programs that are keeping us alive. And we've got if we look at culture as a top-down model, we've got a more, we've got a greedy, self-obsessed, dangerous, violent sort of culture. And then on the other hand, we've got this younger generation that cares, that seemingly cares more about social issues than ever before, that's more generous toward issues like LGBTQ plus people and immigration. And so from the bottom up, it looks hopeful. So I think it's a matter of where you put your frame, you know. I think if we just look at, if we look at Congress, we're in real trouble. You're right. How to infuse empathy in this current bedlam that we're in, I don't know. It's awful.
All right, so don't focus on the 535, but maybe widen it out to the other 330 million or so.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's. I want to bring up a book that you teach in your classes, or did for years, A Human Being Died That Night, and you went to go see a play based upon it. I want you to walk us into the huge stretch of empathy that is represented by the events of that, that play.
Well, it's interesting because I actually went to South Africa to meet with her and spend time and study with her because I got I developed a sort of academic crush. You know, she's
right.
So brilliant. So this woman, Pumlugaboto Madikizela, was an original member of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the original TRC. She was the only psychoanalyst on the commission, and she spent time. She spent 40 hours interviewing a man named Eugene de Kock, who was the head of Vlak Plaas, which is the apartheid's prison. And he's known in South Africa as Prime Evil. And she spent all this time, and he wasn't granted immunity by the TRC because he had committed such gross crimes against humanity. He was given 2 life sentences and 212 years in prison. And she decided to spend time interviewing him to see if she could forgive him personally.
Mm-hmm.
And she drew upon a lot of Holocaust literature as well as South African literature to sort of ask the question, is it a perversion to even beg the question of forgiveness when somebody has committed such evil? Or is it worth it? And so she was trying to think about empathy for the real enemy, empathy for such extreme enemy. And she ultimately decided that not only was he worth forgiving, but he was worth arguing for parole. And so he was granted parole based in part on her testimony and in part on some of the other victims' family testimony. He was granted parole in March of 2015. And so I went to South Africa in March of 2015 to try to understand how people could choose to release this monster. It seemed so unthinkable coming from our cultural stance in the U.S. where we really want to put people away,
mm-hmm.
Especially people that have committed such heinous crimes. It seemed unthinkable to me that we would ever do something like that. And so I went there the week that he was released and spent a lot of time interviewing people that that had actually argued for his parole. I interviewed some victims' families, and then I talked to some people that felt like he should still be in prison. But by and large, the people that I talked to really believed that he should be released because of a kind of empathy they felt, and because they conceived of empathy as an interruption of power, which was a very different notion of empathy than we have here. And by interruption of power, I mean they think of it, or they thought of it there, as if he were left in prison, he could be demonized as the one bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And if he were released, it meant that all of us had to think about our own complicit nature in that system of apartheid.
So that's a lot of complexity and nuance, and I wonder if over the course of the things you learned, not just in South Africa, but over all the period of this book, and we didn't even get into the stuff that happened to you personally,
right.
Can we develop more empathy by talking about it as empathy, or is it a whole lot more complicated than that?
It's a whole lot more complicated than that. I think it's a whole lot of pieces. I mean, I think empathy is one big umbrella term, and then within the umbrella there are a lot of spokes. So that's why I wanted to break it down in this book and really think about it, because it's not just standing in another's shoes. It's not just that. It's a lot of nuance, and that's why it's an interesting subject. And I think that you really hit it on the head when you said, oh, there's an eye roll to it. But it's an interesting because people are squirmy about it. People are squirmy about this notion of empathy because it feels like kind of feel good. Kind of, we're uncomfortable with the feel good. But really, it does some heavy political lifting. It does some heavy emotional lifting. It does a lot of deep work. And it's really useful and interesting.
Are there any places, Chris, where you just don't think it's being used appropriately? I mean, particularly when we start talking about the marketing and machining aspect of it?
I think there are places where it can be used as a sort of colonizing force in a weird way. Like, I think that there are places where the intentions are really good. Like, for example, there's a in New York, we have something, we have a human trafficking intervention court, mm-hmm. which in the last couple of years, we've made prostitution is still illegal, but rather than anybody that's arrested for the crime of prostitution in the state of New York is sent to this human trafficking intervention court, and they are given services rather than time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an empathic model. It's modeled after the drug courts, which are an empathic model. So it's this whole new wave. I can hear the music.
Right. Yeah, so wrap up.
But the trouble is, not everybody's trafficked. So it's an idea where the idea is good, but the implementation is not always so good.
Right, the application is broader than the specifics
exactly.
of the cases. Got it. The book is really going to make you think. It's called I Feel You, The Surprising Power of Extreme Empathy. Chris Beam is its author, and she's been our guest. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you so very much.